Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us at this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're going to start by talking with our friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen, who joins us to talk about church news and current events in light of church teaching. We're going to open with Cardinal Zen's bold Latin Mass statement. He has sent multiple messages to Hong Kong by virtue of this statement, and he's a retired Hong Kong cardinal. He recently posted a photo of himself leading a Eucharistic procession after celebrating the traditional Latin Mass. This photo really does convey a particular stance. We want to talk about this with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, especially in light of the papacy of Pope Leo XIV and all that entails with this continuation of the celebration of the extraordinary form of the Mass. Because while we can acknowledge that there might well be some small pockets of dissent against Rome who identify with the traditional rite, we can also acknowledge that for those people who are tremendously faithful to the magisterium and who enjoy that particular liturgical expression, they found a home and a haven for growth in orthodoxy, in the intellectual tradition, and in deeper love of magisterial authority and fidelity. So we're going to talk about that with Dr. Matthew Bunsen. We go on from there to talk with Dr. Anne Bradley. Economics is the study of how finite and fallen human beings make decisions under conditions of scarcity, Thomas Sowell makes that very clear, and uncertainty. By understanding the basics of reality, you and I can ask essential questions. How ought we to cultivate greater human flourishing? What ought we to do with our capacity of, frankly, co-creation? The language of co-creation doesn't have to wait for heaven. We actually, frankly, don't co-create in heaven the same way. In this material sphere here on earth, however, God didn't do a finished, completed work of creation. He said it was good. God finished his work. He created man to till and to keep the garden, to subjugate it, to bring it under dominion. And therefore, in that work, man creates value. Man creates opportunity. Man creates structures that, frankly, accrue wealth, and that wealth uplifts out of poverty and creates true human flourishing. All this we talk about after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, June 26th. It's the feast of St. Jose Maria Escriva. And today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. The White House confirms the FBI is investigating the leak of an intel report challenging the effectiveness of the U.S. strikes against Iran's nuclear sites. Today, Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt insisted Iran was weeks away from developing a nuclear weapon before Trump ordered their sites to be obliterated by U.S. bombers. She defended the president's decision to now limit the sharing of classified information with Congress, saying very few people had access to the report. The Supreme Court is backing South Carolina's effort to cut funds for Planned Parenthood. The organization was looking to challenge the state from banning it from taking part in the Medicaid program because of the abortion care it provides. It was a 6-3 vote, with the court's three liberal justices dissenting. The decision opens the door for other conservative states to go after Planned Parenthood. Temperatures are finally starting to drop in the U.S. The heat dome that's been raising temperatures across the central and eastern U.S. is starting to lift today. Forecasters say temperatures will start falling in the northeast, where places like New York and New England have been reporting record heat. High temperatures will start tapering off in the mid-Atlantic and the southeast through Friday. And on this day in rock and roll history, in 1977, Elvis Presley gave a concert at the Indianapolis Market Square Arena, which ended up being his last public appearance. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Joining me as he does every Thursday is Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director for EWTN News, and we're talking about church news and current events in light of church teaching. Matthew, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Oh, great to be with you, as always.
Always a pleasure to connect with you. So I want to jump right in with talking about Cardinal Joseph Zen and his Latin Mass statement, and if I might invite you to speculate on some of the intent of it and what that might mean.
Yeah, I think if you also go to ncregister.com, Matt McDonald has a very interesting piece on that very question and that very mm-hmm. story. And one of the things that is very clear is, first, let's remind everyone that Cardinal Joseph Zen, who is one of, I would describe as one of the great lions in the church today, he's in his 90s. He's the emeritus bishop of Hong Kong. He has faced arrest by Chinese communist authorities on charges of collusion with so-called foreign forces. He remains under watch from authorities there. So anything that he says or does is worth noting. And in this case, he made the decision to celebrate the extraordinary form of the Roman Rite, the traditional Latin Mass, the Tridentine Mass, at a parish in Hong Kong, and then led a Eucharistic procession through the streets of the campus of the parish. Now, that is pretty significant in itself, but I think you ask a really important question, Mark. What's the message that he's sending?
Right.
And what we know about Cardinal Zen is that he is utterly fearless when it comes to speaking out on things.
Yeah.
And from that standpoint, I think he's first telling Chinese authorities, as he has for many, many years, that religious freedom is paramount, that there are rights that believers should have, and he is exercising what he believes is a right to process through the streets, to have this religious statement, spiritual statement. I think he's also defying Chinese authorities who have been trying to diminish the role of religion or to cynicize the role of religion with the most traditional form of liturgy that he could find. And of course, it's hard to find a more traditional form of liturgy than the Tridentine Mass.
That's right.
I think he's also speaking out on behalf of the traditional Latin Mass at a time when there are a lot of questions about what is going to lie ahead for it in the decision-making of Pope Leo XIV. So I think a lot of layers here, but once again, one has to just stand back and salute Cardinal Zen for his heroism.
And Matthew, like what you mentioned earlier, if I may ask you to go deeper in terms of Cardinal Zen's statement, if you will, or at least stance against the patriotic church, because it's no secret at this point that he has had words and actions that have stood very clearly against some of the movements of the Patriotic Church of China.
Yeah, that's right. He is one of those voices. Now, let's remember that ostensibly, at least, Hong Kong is an SAR, so it's what's known as a special administrative region. So it's supposed to be under slightly different rules of scrutiny and, well, to put it bluntly, oppression than you're apt to see in mainland China, in sort of the rest of the People's Republic of China. The Chinese government has done a twofold thing. First, they have really ratcheted up the levels of oppression and efforts to control all religions in China, especially through Premier Xi Jinping's process of, I just used that word, cynicization.
Mm-hmm.
It varies a little bit from province to province in China, but one can say sort of writ large that Christianity in particular, but all religions, as we can see, like with the Uyghurs in Western China, are facing severe scrutiny and levels of oppression. Hong Kong is supposed to be a little different, but we know that various freedoms that were guaranteed have slowly been withered away as the Chinese government itself begins and has tried to impose more regulations and more control over life there. So I think one thing, as we were just saying, that Cardinal Zen is sending this message that Hong Kong has to have these rights respected that were supposedly guaranteed by the Chinese government years ago, and going all the way back to the end of the 90s when they first took control of Hong Kong from Great Britain.
Right. Who knows how long that is going to be, considering that there's been tremendous push for overreach of mainland China on the administrative state of Hong Kong. But as we consider this, I think for the sake of our listeners, Matthew, just to round off this conversation, the problem of sinicization, just for context, isn't a call for the church to control the state, rather the reverse. It's calling for a state church, and it presents a whole host of religious liberty problems, and the Vatican has worked very hard to try to establish conversation with China because of that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, that in some ways goes to one of the goals of this the China-Vatican Pact. Now, we don't know what the exact terms are. And it's been stressed that this is not a treaty, this is not a concordat in the traditional sense of the word, and it really is supposed to help to regulate or to regularize how bishops are appointed. So from that standpoint, it is seen as, certainly from the Vatican standpoint, a desired next step in the normalization of relations. Now, let's be blunt, that Cardinal Zen has been one of, if not the fiercest critic of the Vatican deal with the People's Republic of China, in large measure because of the numerous and frankly egregious violations on the part of the People's Republic of China with regard to that, to the agreement. But Cardinal Zen is sending a message here, I think, about the importance of defending the rights of believers in China. But I think he's also, this is a gesture, I think, and I can't speak obviously for Cardinal Zen, but I think he's also doing this as a symbol of solidarity with all of the Catholics in Hong Kong, but also all of the Catholics in China, that he is with them, but they are all in this together and facing this level of oppression on the part of the People's Republic.
And so I'd like to pivot before the end of the segment. We've got about 2 minutes. Let's talk about the Pew study about the percentage of Catholics who voted for Trump in 2024 and what that means.
Yeah, this is a very interesting report because it's one of those opportunities to go back and take a look at exactly what happened in the 24 campaign. We know, or headed into this study, that Trump had carried the Catholic vote. We have seen that in numerous exit pollings and elsewhere, but this gives us the first really solid study of that. And the Pew Group is very good at providing, this research center is very good at sort of getting into these numbers. What it tells us is that Trump basically did solidly carry the Catholic vote, I think with about 55%. Right. Of Catholic voters over Kamala Harris, who had 43%. Now, if we go back to previous elections, which I think in particular 2020, the vote itself was almost perfectly split between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, 50-49. So at that point, you can see that heading into 2024, the Catholic vote swung very significantly for Donald Trump. What is so interesting, though, is that there are a couple of things from this report. The first is that 80% of Trump voters identified as Christian. So that solidifies, at least for this set of election cycles, that Donald Trump is solidly supported by people who consider themselves Christian. And marks, too, I think, a fairly significant shift in, at least, again, this election cycle, the demographic supporters for the Democratic Party, which we have assumed, but this validates that assumption, are less religious. And I know we can pick up this discussion on the other side.
I'm talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News. We're talking about church and news. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Catholic Charities of Shiawassee and Genesee counties have been providing health and creating hope since 1941. It's the generosity of donors that allows them to provide necessary services such as their warming center, which provides refuge and comfort to thousands in our community. They also offer hot meals in their soup kitchens and help families make ends meet in their community closet. Even the smallest donation makes a meaningful difference. Join us in their mission by giving a donation at CatholicCharitiesFlint.org.
Welcome to an Advanced Dentistry Center family. This is Dr. Metti, and our team strives to treat you like family in a loving and compassionate way as we focus on serving you in a Christ-like manner. We do this by emphasizing prevention and general well-being for a lifetime. Our private practice is small, personal, state-of-the-art, and innovative, with the goal to educate and motivate our patients in improving their oral health. It is through a partnership with you that you will achieve the goals for your smile. Advanced Dentistry is serious about the level of care we provide, with attention to details and an exceptional level of care, skill, and judgment. We are thrilled for the opportunity to serve you.
Dr. Matty and the team invite you to visit them at AdvancedDentistryCenter.com or call them at 248-594-9592. That's 248-594-9592. AdvancedDentistryCenter.com. Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Pease. I'm talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News. And Matthew, we had just left off talking about how in the 2024 election, the majority, and maybe even the vast majority, one could say, of people who voted for Trump in some capacity identified as Christian. That's a significant demographic fact.
It is. Yeah, that's exactly right. So it tells you, as we're looking at the deeper trends, that those who are more religious, in particular, more Christian, tend for, again, election cycles change, and we have seen fluctuations over the years, that they very much are in the camp of the Republican Party, but in particular for Donald Trump. And so that, we have to focus on that. Now, again, we always stipulate that those numbers can change in exactly the same way that the base for the Republican Party has shifted somewhat over election cycles to support blue-collar workers, that type of and also levels of education. The other two things, though, that really jump out at me in this is the confirmation that this gives us that Latino voters or Hispanic voters have progressively marched into the Trump camp. Now, as we know, Latinos are the fastest growing demographic for Catholics in the United States. So long term, that could be very significant. What this says is that he did much better with Latinos. Basically, 48% of Hispanic voters voted for Trump in 2024. That's up from 28% in 2016. Now, if you look at those numbers, obviously, then that's a strong body of voters for Donald Trump. The other is the progress that he made among African-American voters. And I found especially interesting the number of Protestant voters, but also black voters, black Protestant voters. There was a heavy shift for him in this last election, with some 15% of black Protestants voting for Donald Trump. I suspect that a lot of it has to do with social issues and then also economic issues. One overarching aspect to this is that, as has been the case with many election cycles, Catholics tend to vote with the majority in election after election. In other words, Catholic voters seem to be very good at picking winners when it comes to a presidential election. But it also tells us that the average American Catholic voter tends to look a lot like regular voters and the rest of the voters. And it raises that longstanding sort of philosophical and demographic question of what exactly is a Catholic voter.
I want to ask if your insight on this, if you recall, Tim Walz made a statement that he was elected to be Harris's running mate so that he could appeal to the male, but especially the white male demographic, just in light of these statistics right now. If you could just comment.
Yeah, I think as we have seen in a number of exit polls and studies of the election, one of the areas where the Democratic Party has definitely struggled is among male white voters, including younger male white voters, so the Caucasians. Now, the Democratic Party, as we have also seen to some degree in this New York primary for mayor, where the liberal white women tend in very large majorities gravitate toward the Democratic Party. But we've also seen, again, those inroads among African-American men in moving toward Donald Trump, as we saw in 2024, and the numbers just keep increasing. So there is, in addition to the religious gap, there is an economic gap, there's an education gap, and now I think we're also very clearly seeing a type of gender gap, but not necessarily in the way that we have traditionally thought of it, that it's simply a female-male divide. It is also very much how we target or look at these different groups. Again, with Trump doing in 2024 surprisingly well among the very voters who were supposedly the ones who would be least inclined to vote for him.
I want to ask if we can pivot to talk about some disheartening news about the assisted suicide bill. In the as was the comment of John Sherrington of Liverpool.
Yeah, for those who haven't been following this bill called the Terminally Ill Adults, the End of Life Bill, which essentially opens the door massively to permit terminally ill adults to end their lives, again, with the help of a physician, passed the House of Commons in Parliament in England, albeit by what some found to be a surprisingly narrow margin. It was expected that it would probably pass because the Labour Party at this point is, I think we can safely characterize it as a very far left group. It is a very far left party in England.
Right.
The vote was 315 to 291. Now, the bill itself now goes to the House of Lords. The likelihood, as I understand it, of the House of Lords being able to derail it is very low. I've had some people say it simply can't do that. Now, it might be possible for the House of Lords to amend the bill, but I think the likelihood is that this will become the law of the land. Now, let's remember, too, that this comes on the heels just a few days ago, in this month, that the Parliament also voted to decriminalize abortion for women in England and Wales, which itself has now opened once again also the floodgates for increases in abortion. So we're seeing on two different fronts, on the assisted suicide front and then the abortion front, the embrace of what we can safely say is the culture of death in England. And it has really set off many alarms, including among the British, the English bishops, and the bishop who oversees the life issues for the Episcopal Conference of England and Wales, it's Archbishop John Sherrington of Liverpool, as you noted, it has expressed very grave concerns about this. But he used a great phrase in his statement to EWTN News, and that's, we have crossed a watershed, a kind of fundamental line in the sand about the protection of life and that one cannot assist another person's suicide. And we know, based on the experience that we've seen in Canada and elsewhere, that once you begin down this road, there's no end to it. And it becomes looser and looser and more likely that whatever restrictions they have in place now or whatever limitations will soon be lifted. We need to look only at what they've done now in abortion in the United Kingdom to see what's going to happen with assisted suicide.
Yep. And therefore, that raises questions about conscientious objectors to the issue. So, in terms of healthcare professionals who object on the basis of conscience, but also just the average populace about praying, how is this bill going to affect all of that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the other attached concerns to this is that, yes, there's supposed to be some sort of freedom of conscience for doctors.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that healthcare workers, social workers, anyone who is engaged in care for the terminally ill may not actually fall under that classification. So in other words, non-doctor medical workers or medical professionals may actually have no freedom to say that their conscience prohibits them from participating in assisted suicide. And as we all know, at a time when things like the NHS, the National Health System in England is struggling financially, that there is always going to be a push now, unfortunately. We see that institutionally toward the embrace of things like assisted suicide. If nothing else, the cold numbers, pragmatic, cool decisions of making decisions for end of life, trying to push families and terminally ill patients. We all know how this ends and where this ends.
Yep. And so we're rounding off, Matthew. I just want to say thank you very, very much for your time.
Oh, a joy to be with you, as always. I wish sometimes that the news were better.
We'll get there one day.
We will. One day.
My guest has been Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News. We've been talking about pieces of church news. There are a lot of things that we have to pray for and hope for. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Is your child struggling with math or reading? Want to boost their grades and confidence? Hi, this is Ed Bahura. Welcome to Sylvan Learning Centers, where success is just a session away. With 45 years of experience, Sylvan Learning offers help in reading, math, college prep, and much more, with flexible schedules, affordable rates, and interest-free financing. Enroll today and watch your child's confidence soar. Catch up, keep up, and get ahead. Call 1-800-EDUCATE.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Ann Arbor Smiles is a state-of-the-art dental practice led by the talents of Drs. Dan Kennedy, Chris Marzoni, and Stephen Gray. One of their many satisfied patients is Father Deacon Lawrence Hendricks.
I was one of the first patients to receive a Sarah crown from Dr. Kennedy. The Sarah technology allows for restorations to be done in one visit. they always use the most advanced techniques in dentistry. I've always enjoyed the friendly staff and the personal relationships that I have at Ann Arbor Smiles.
Go to AnnArborSmiles.com today.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, coming to you from Acton University 2025. I'm joined by Dr. Anne Rathbone Bradley, George and Sally Mayer Fellow for Economic Education, and she's delivering a course entitled, one of the core courses here at Acton University, entitled The Economic Way of Thinking. Anne, thank you for being here. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm very well. Thank you. Excited to be at Acton.
Well, it's a real highlight of our year. We look forward to it all year. And that's where I'd like to begin. So sure. With these core courses, it's very clear that Acton is trying to not just set the tone, but also define our terms. Mm-hmm. What do we mean by words like innovation, entrepreneurship, the human dignity, and co-creatorship? Within that context, within that language, and taking a look at the course that you're teaching, this concept that a human person is called, whether or not they are working in the industrial sphere, to be economic individuals, that's virtually alien to a de-Christianized but also de-natural law-ized culture. In that light, let's reframe that conversation, that man is called to be an economic being.
I love your question because I think it's where we should start, and that's why I spend so much time in the core course really trying to lay down the anthropological realities.
Yeah.
The economic realities tie in with those, and those all tie in with God's created order.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot possibly understand big policy issues, global, international economic affairs.
Yeah.
You know, I think those are the things we hear about on the news, but we're not always able to tie them down to the individual, and that's where this all starts.
Right.
So it's not that necessarily some of us are economic man or woman and some are not. It's just a part of our anthropology.
Yep.
And so I think part of that, and you can stop me anytime, but
no.
Just to give a few more details, it is that we are finite and limited in what we are able to do. And this has always been true. So this is true before the fall because we are not equal with God. But we are made in his image, in his likeness, and in that we are creative creators. And in Genesis 1, we're asked to take dominion,
yep.
Be fruitful and multiply. That is going to... So we understand the multiply. We understand family
yeah,
life.
Yeah.
We have a lot of sessions at Acton that deal with that. And, of course, that's under assault in our culture. But I also think this idea that you bring up, that just like the idea of that we are economic agents,
mm-hmm.
Even if that you're not working as a hedge fund manager on Wall
right.
Street, people tend to think of those as, okay, those people are maybe doing economics. But it's just the living out your life as a steward of what God has given you,
yep.
in the realities of who you are, which is we face scarcity,
yes.
But we are able to create something out of something, and that's part of how we cultivate human flourishing.
Right.
And so I think the economics of it is alien, like you said, to a lot of people in the Christian community,
yeah.
because they think of it as stewardship and discipleship in the church and in the community and our missions. That is all important, and that is all a part of how you allocate your scarce resources. But it's also, if God calls you to work and get paid for that, we shouldn't dismiss that. It's just like, oh, God doesn't care about that. That's secular.
Right.
No, God cares about that because he made you to do it.
Yeah. In fact, when we take a look at the first few pages of Genesis, when Adam is planted in Eden, there's a very distinct command there. So in Genesis chapter 1, you get the language of subjugate the world, bring it under your dominion. And so the command is very clear there that it's not just stewardship for the sake of it. That language has to do with working and tilling. So in Genesis 2, you see these words, till and keep, to shamar at avodah, to work this creation. And so we get here this language of co-creation, which is the work of economics. The oikonomia here has to do with the cultivation of that which God has created, but God didn't make it perfect. He wants man to participate in it.
I think that's right, and I think when you look at the 7 days of creation, it is good, it is good, it is good. It is very good on the last day, but it's not finished. And that's why that verse in Genesis 2 is so important, because it would be a different life that we are asked to lead here on earth if the order or command from God was, I made this beautiful, which it was, of course, beautiful, abundant creation. Now, watch over it, but don't change it.
Right.
That is different than watch over it, guard it, protect it, because there's deep value in it. Yeah. But also, change it. And how do you change it? Through the work of your hands. And through the application of human creativity to those resources we were given. And so, I think the expectation is that we are to innovate. I think we can understand that God created the world out of just nothing, right? Out of he's the ultimate architect.
Right.
He can do things we can't do, but he's given us this and asked us to steward it. And I think there's a lot of eternal significance in our work. That's an implication from that, which most of us don't think about. I mean, think about the mundane things of your life.
Right.
I'm a professor, so I grade papers. You know, that's not always the most exciting thing or the thing I want to do all the time. But there's
really, you don't enjoy grading?
Some people, right, when professors retire, they say, well, I'm not going to stop working. I'm going to stop grading. So, you know, I mean, it and we all have things that we don't love to do in our jobs. And that's, again, unpaid labor. You know, parenting is hard.
Yeah.
It's not all rewarding in the same way, or at least you don't feel it in the moment. But it's valuable, and that sacrifice is important. So,
right.
I think that that idea that if you're called to be an accountant, that God has given you the gifts and talents to do that.
Yeah.
In doing that, you're able to serve other people who don't have those gifts and talents. This is a way that we love our neighbor.
Right.
And that's kind of a radical idea, maybe. And I think that's our responsibility. So it takes the secular out of what we think is secular.
You know, even as you're talking, I'm remembering Father Sirico in The Entrepreneurial Vocation, which I know you draw in your course, but also authors I've read in the past, people like Thomas Sowell in Basic Economics, and you start getting an understanding that whether we like, or even Michael Novak, right, whether we like it or not, these basic fundamental laws that govern the market, especially if the market is left not so much unregulated, but at least untampered with, if you work within the bounds of the market, you start seeing the human ingenuity and human innovation really do become the driving force for the avenue of growth, creation, and not just affluence, but actual wealth creation before it can be distributed.
That's right. You have to create something that can be distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when we think of redistribution, of course you think about the government, because the government has the monopoly of force. So the government can simply say, this is your tax rate, and based on your income, and we will take it from you, and you don't have to like that. But that's if they're a legitimate government that's enabled to take your money. They can do it. They will. And so, you know, that's what we tend to think of, but I think your point is opens up a new set of questions, which is, where does the government get their money? They have to have a robust market economy from which to draw resources, and that robust market economy has to be able to grow over time.
Right.
So in a country like the United States, the government is big, but the market is bigger.
Right.
We also kind of, I think, not at Acton, but in general, culturally, we downplay the very powerful and important role of civil society. So what are the role of these civic institutions that are not firms, they're not profit maximizers, but they're also not government agents, they don't have the monopoly of force, but they are very powerful. So you mentioned Michael Novak, I think Thomas Sowell understands this, de Tocqueville.
Yes.
This is his observation, right, is that, wow, there's something unique about the United States, which is that people are living out their conscience by helping each other. They're solving local community problems.
Right.
I think there's been a lot of crowding out over the last, especially kind of 125 years, We have this very large federal government. We have very large state governments. And so...
And we ceded ground to them.
We have ceded ground to them, absolutely. And I think that the church has been crowded out in some ways by the state and by these... Because the state has just the ability to command more resources than the church. So I think about 150 years ago, if your house burned down, your neighbors would help you for a long time. Most likely, they would help you rebuild your home. Mm-hmm. They would provide you with food. Right. They would let you sleep in their house. And it would be a pitching in of the community.
Right.
And they were people who knew you. You were a member of this community. And so they wanted you to survive and succeed. But there was never, I think, the expectation among those community members that we're going to let you live in our house forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's that, you know, you lost something due to a tragedy and we're going to help you repair that. Yep. And then we expect you to kind of go back to self-subsistence and that type of thing. And so I think welfare works in a very different way.
That's right.
And it's not that the idea behind welfare is not a compassionate one. I believe it is. But I think if we are distorting those institutions that actually are a buffer against the government and against government growth, then that's where we find ourselves today in this situation.
My guest is Dr. Anne Rathbone Bradley, George and Sally Mayer Fellow for Economic Education, Vice President of Academic Affairs at the Fund for American Studies. She's also teaching a course called The Economic Way of Thinking at Acton University 2025. Continuing on the other side of the break, stay tuned.
St. Joseph's Helper's mission is not only to repair homes for those in need, but to repair hearts by providing companionship and peace of mind, especially for veterans and the elderly. But they cannot meet the great needs of our community without volunteers like you. If you have the skills to complete small two-hour home repair projects, to help in our office, or to be a prayer minister, visit sjhelpers.org today to let us know your availability. That's sjhelpers.org. St. Joseph's Helpers, giving dignity, spreading hope.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Ron Finn here, inviting you to join Dave Basharis, Pat Odie-Murray, and me for Morning Offering, the Catholic way to start your day.
We welcome some very special guests each day, including Teresa Tamio, Andrew Reinhart, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and Matthew Archbold. Plus, my chat with Pat, talking with Catholic experts from all over.
Plus, we're having fun along the way, so you can start your day with a smile. Morning Offering, weekday mornings at 8, here on the Ave Maria Radio family of stations.
What does the Eucharist do for daily conversion and penance? The Catholic Catechism tells us we are fed by the Eucharist, for in it, Christ's sacrifice on the cross, which reconciles us to God, is made present. The Council of Trent declared that the Eucharist is a remedy to free us from our daily faults and to preserve us from mortal sins. Such devotions as reading sacred scripture, praying the liturgy of the hours, the Our Father, and every sincere act of worship revives the spirit of conversion and repentance within us and contributes to the forgiveness of sins. The Catechism cites the parable of the prodigal son and the very merciful father as a classic tale of conversion, saying only the heart of Christ, who knows the depths of his father's love, could reveal it to us in such a simple and beautiful way. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio.
Ave Maria Radio.
My dad, sharp as a tack, but getting him out for a dentist trip got harder every year. When he moved to the senior residence where he lives now, Dr. Mansour's portable dental service was a godsend. Dr. Mansour comes to wherever the homebound patient may be, whether in a nursing facility or the comfort of home. All the services you'd expect in a dentist office brought straight to the patient's door. Call 586-873-5567. That's 586-873-5567 or portabledentalservices.com.
Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm speaking with Dr. Anne Rathbone Bradley. She is a professor at Acton University 2025, and she is teaching one of the core courses called The Economic Way of Thinking. So, Anne, we were talking earlier about a few things happened. First of all, we saw mainline Protestantism lose its hold in the American culture at large. But it wasn't just here in America. We saw globally how the rationalistic revolt in the Enlightenment have the church lose hold in most of the West. And when that happened, something else had to take its place. And eventually, especially here in America, you see that the government starts stepping into the forefront. And so individuals became hyper-individualistic. Mm-hmm. The sexual revolution virtually guaranteed that. And in the process, we allowed the government to just take over those areas where small communities, where subsidiarity used to rule the day for human flourishing. And we're paying the price today.
It's a big problem that you address, and it begs important questions about what you do about it.
Yeah.
I think some of the times we believe that the way to fix the problem is to actually give the government more power, to, right?
Yeah.
And so that's clearly not going to work. I think one thing economics certainly can teach us is that we are not hyper-rational individuals.
Yeah.
So let me give you an example. I like to teach my students this. So we talk about rational choice theory, and what we mean as economists is not that you're like walking around with a spreadsheet, you know, one of those like cartoon bubbles that pops up, the thought bubbles, and that when you go into the grocery store and there's a sale that you didn't expect, you like do all these computations and like, oh, this box of cereal's on sale. Mm-hmm. I wasn't expecting it, so let me robotically calculate. We don't really operate that way,
yeah.
And I don't think that's a necessary assumption of rational choice theory. Mm-hmm. We're merely saying that people have a set of preferences that are deeply subjective to them,
yeah.
And that they make choices based on those, all the while trying to maximize their personal benefits,
right,
and lower the cost. But I always say we're really doing expected cost versus expected benefit analysis because we don't ever know the full picture.
Right.
So this notion that somehow we can kind of live as automatons on these islands has never been true.
Yep.
But I actually think that this is an incorrect critique of kind of classical liberalism. So I have to use the word liberalism carefully,
yes,
right?
Yes,
I mean the good kind of liberalism. So classical liberalism was never advocating,
yep,
for this kind of atomistic individualism,
yep,
where you don't need anyone else and you can do everything on your own. And because that's so false, we should not scratch our heads when people run to the state to fix the problems that is created by that mentality.
Right.
So if the mentality is... So you might remember that during the Obama administration, so I'm just going to pick on him for a moment, but I think many politicians are very guilty of this type of thinking. And it was a short video, and it was called The Life of Julia. And The Life of Julia was about, you know, kind of the trajectory of a woman, a young woman from girl to woman in America. And it basically showed that at different time periods, the government is involved in her whole life. The government is providing maternal care. The government might be subsidizing daycare or providing K-12 education or providing federal loans for college or giving her access to different pharmaceuticals, all this type of stuff. And the implication is that if the government didn't make all these investments from birth to adulthood, that you don't get adults, that you don't get prosperous,
yeah,
adults.
Okay.
And so this idea is absurd, which is that, I mean, back to our story of, you know, 200 or 150 years ago, somebody's barn burning down. Then there's no federal government system to protect you against
That's
that.
Right.
Tragedies happen. We don't want them to happen. technological innovation helps us avoid or lower the probability of some of those tragedies, but when they happen, we come together socially, locally, communally, and we help each other. And this can really work.
Right.
And so this notion that you are this atomistic individual, you don't need any help from anyone, defies human anthropology, and it actually defies the assumption of economics.
Right.
And so, but I think when you believe those kind of things, then when they're obviously doomed to fail,
right,
then we tend to say, okay, we need more provisions from the state. Maybe, so now we're talking about things like free daycare, a year of paid maternity leave.
Right,
I have
right.
two children. I would have loved to have a year off, right? This would have been amazing, but yeah. I don't have the right
yep.
to make a claim on someone else's income.
That's right.
To provide me what I say I want.
Right.
So I think we do have to make hard choices. Being a working mom is a difficult set of choices. Being a stay-at-home mom is a difficult yeah. set of choices. There's trade-offs everywhere. Mm-hmm. The best bet against the trade-offs is a robust market economy that yeah. allows us to lower our opportunity costs over time, and a robust civil society that can help people where they
right.
need help.
When Thomas Sowell says that scarcity is the fundamental law of the economic market, really what he's talking about is exactly what you said. There are trade-offs to every decision. And that
Everywhere.
Draws me back to, you and I were drawing from Michael Novak earlier. It's Spirit of Democratic Capitalism.
Yes, a wonderful book.
What bothers me about it is, not only was he right, he was also prophetic, that the more we cede the grounds of human innovation and ingenuity to large government and centralized authority, the more the human person winds up being viewed as nothing more than this cog in a wheel, this mouth
That's
to be
right.
fed. And then all of a sudden you start thinking that the economy is a closed system, rather than this market with certain laws that allow for the creation of wealth and innovation and entrepreneurship.
That's right. And so cogs in systems have to just be moved around.
That's right.
You know, it's the analogy is there's a chessboard with players
uh-huh.
and there's a mastermind who can not only move the players around in time period one, but great chess players think, right, moves down the road,
yep,
four or five
yeah.
moves in the future. And so the central planner would have to be able to do that. And
yeah.
I use that language, central planner, but the policymaker in the
yeah.
United States, right? If we're going to agitate for minimum wage is a great example. Minimum wage sounds like a really good idea,
mm.
right? We are worried about people with lower levels of income and education. We're worried about their income mobility, and they want to be able to feed their family. All these are really important and relevant concerns.
Yep.
But the idea of a minimum wage is that we know what they need to make. We know what the trade-offs are. There will be no significant unintended consequences, and there will be no change in incentives in the future for
right.
entrepreneurs who run these businesses that
right.
pay the workers.
Right.
So I just think it's a big problem in the perception of what policy is able to do.
Yep.
My professor in graduate school, Peter Bedke, who's going to be doing a lecture at Acton tomorrow, he always taught us that economics puts parameters on our utopias. And I think this utopian thinking is on the left and the right.
Yep.
It's this, if you give us control, political control, we can carve out the perfect kind of set of policies
right.
and we can craft the future that we want. Again, back to the chessboard, right? We can't do that. And so sometimes I think what economics informs us of is that you just have to remove roadblocks
uh-huh.
that stand in people's way. What if the minimum wage is a roadblock to entrepreneurship?
That's right.
Which would create more jobs for low-skilled workers.
That's right. And from there, we start realizing that even the notion of a utopia, which you really see come forth with a particular, Marxist ideology, the Frankfurt School really pushes forth that notion. But the premise, however, is that there's this kind of idyllic societal structure that we can eventually get to. The moment we accept that, A, we are a fallen race, we are a fallen nature, this is a fallen world. But within this fallen world, there are laws that work in our, natural laws, that work in our favor.
That's right.
And that we are true moral entrepreneurial agents.
Yes.
We can actually start being participants in God's grace for the flourishing of our common good and human development.
That's right. And I don't think when we are looking at the magazines, who are the people that make the covers of the magazines? It's the billionaire entrepreneurs. And they're great, right? My life is better with Amazon in it
right.
because I can get packages, things that I need delivered.
Overnight.
It saves me a lot of time. People really value that service. And I think that, again, another lesson of a market economy is that it's not perfect, especially from a Christian perspective, right? Because if there's a demand for things that we think are wrong to consume outright, like pornography or drugs or something like this, in a market setting, there would be supply that comes about to respond to that demand.
Right.
So I actually think this goes back to Novak as well, which is, what do you do about that? I mean, I think he understood that laws were important and the rule of law was important, but also culture matters and ideas matter. The values that people hold are reflective of the institutions that they live in.
That's right.
Especially in a democratic kind of economy or democratic political system that's also a market economy. So,
right.
you know, Jim Otteson always says that markets empower the no thank you. So in a market economy, you don't have to buy something or consume something that you disagree with, that
right.
you don't want, that you don't like, that you don't think you should be consuming.
Uh-huh.
So we are enabled with the no thank you. And it's a peaceful no thank you.
Yep.
And I think there's a lot of power in that. But I think this comes back to belief systems and ideas. And it goes back to our earlier conversation, which is we have just kind of ceded to the state.
Yep.
I think in some ways the church.
Yep, we did.
Has ceded to the state. And so how do we get that back? I think about, back to my, you know, kind of tragic example of the house burning down. Today, if your house burns down, would my church help? They would absolutely help. They would maybe let, you know, church members would let us live with them for a time.
Right.
Or they would feed us with meals. Certainly, there might be a GoFundMe campaign. These are good things. But I also think they would say, make sure that, you know, there aren't any kind of welfare provisions that you might be able to have. And
mm-hmm.
on its face, there's nothing wrong with that. But again, I think that when people get caught in even local and state, but certainly federal welfare systems, I think that they get trapped in dependency.
Yeah.
And so I think that we really see this in
low-income communities,
yep. right? So forget the tragic story of the house burning down, but just you're born into a low-income
yep.
community. Maybe there's a lot of gang violence and a lot of drugs and a lot of prostitution, and the schools are very mm. poor and very, you know, bad educational outcomes. This is not your fault.
Yeah.
And you might have a single mom, and she's working as hard as she can, and she can't provide everything you need. So naturally, the state is there to help you. Of course people would accept that help.
Right.
But I think the church can take a more active role.
Yeah.
And what the church offers people is relationship. The federal government treats you as an individual. Well, not even really an individual.
A unit.
You fit into a box, right? But there are no such individuals. And so what the church has the power to do, and I think what God has commanded us to do, is to form relationships with people that are in those situations, because that's how we help them get out in the long run.
And I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. So fun.
My guest has been Dr. Anne Rathbone Bradley. She's an affiliate scholar at the Acton Institute, and we are at Acton University 2025, and teaches the course, The Economic Way of Thinking, which is one of the core courses at Acton University. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.